Yo.
There's certain things that I can talk to you about that I can't really with my dad.
I don't think we should talk about this.
Hello, this is Lynn, Lynn and Jen, and let's talk about sex. And really, we're a different group than we started out. We're now kind of Lynn and Soy and Valerie, and let's talk about sex. And today's conversation is really about a very tough subject, which is working with those who are involved in sexual offenses. And as often in working with individuals who have engaged in this, many of them have also been offended against and have suffered. So it's really kind of a combination, but it's really talking about all of our experiences working with those who've engaged in sexual offenses. So we're trying to keep it open to many different ideas, and we recognize, I think, Soy, this is a pretty challenging field.
Yeah, it's been so, so incredibly difficult, so, so incredibly rewarding to work with folks, and definitely frustrating because, not because of the people, I think, but more so because of how our systems are set up. And so we can definitely get into that a little bit more, but I have so many opinions about the ways that our systems are set up, and sometimes in ways that are harmful, not to just people who are trying to get better who've harmed other people, but to the people who've been harmed. So anyway, I'll stop there because Valerie might have something else to say too.
That was great, Soy. Yes. Hi guys, I'm Valerie. I'm a student, so I've only, you know, really learned about ways to approach this treatment. But I do firmly believe in harm reduction. So I think we're going to talk about a lot of harm reduction today and the treatments of pedophilia as a disease. And, you know, sex abuse is something that a lot of people experience and come forward and are able to sort of get strength from each other to survive what they have overcome. But also what happens to the people that have abused them? They don't just go away. They have healing to do. So I think that harm reduction is, you know, a big part of that, and creating a system where, you know, people that have abused can come forward and, you know, lean on each other and try to heal from that.
And I think we're all talking about something very important, which is you started, Soy, by talking about the system. And the system really alienates people who do abuse, as well as victims. I mean, victims are alienated too. They feel it hard to come forward and talk about it. But those who have engaged in sexual offending really pick up the overall cultural view, which is you are a pariah. You should not talk about this. You should deny it. You should lie about it. All of these things. And this greatly affects changing viewpoints and behavior. You know, makes it really, really hard to work with this population. I was just going to start with a few kind of clinical situations so we can start talking about the actual work and a couple of ways I've worked with those involved in offenses. One is I'll be treating an individual who's come in around being victimized, sexually abused as a child, or, you know, sexually abused as an adult, harassed, and then it will come out that they have engaged in sexual offenses and abuse toward others. And that's a big, big part of it, you know, is really their treatment now is really, you know, under this overall umbrella. It often takes a long time for people to admit that they too have engaged in these sexual offenses, which I think reflects our culture, that it's really hard to admit or accept these parts of ourselves. I don't know if this has been your experience, Soy, with people you've worked with, but is this a way you see them come into therapy, is through that route?
I don't know if I am maybe someone who is an outlier, but I never got any like court appointed referrals. Folks who I've worked with have all been voluntary. And so it's, I don't know if that's an unusual thing, but they don't, not everyone starts by saying, I harmed someone. And some do. Some are really straight, like forthcoming about it. Where I do see some similarities are this desire to want to take accountability, but then this disavow for this part that has harmed another person. And it does make me wonder if there is a societal, like that stigma that comes from society that makes it really difficult for someone to take that ownership. Like, I am someone who can hurt other people. It's actually, this is a reading that I send to some of the folks that I've worked with, but I hate this title, Can Bad Men Change? What It's Like Inside Sex Offender Therapy. It's an article from The Time. And it's these clinicians who run groups for folks. I think these are court mandated folks, but they run groups for folks who had some sort of sexual assault charge or offense or conviction. And part of the work is trying to help someone take accountability, like full accountability for what they've done. And I think instead of making like, I'm a bad person, be a part of someone's identity, trying to disentangle that with, I've done something to hurt someone and I have to accept that I am capable of being a human who can hurt someone, instead of I'm a bad person, I think is so crucial in the work. And it's a challenge when the systems are set up and people are also making comments like these people are monsters and blah, blah, like that makes it really hard for someone to face and take accountability for the harm they've caused. So sorry, that was a long spiel, but I'm feeling real passionate about this area.
But, you know, this is an area I think if we work in it, we do start to feel passionate about, and it's a tough area. So there's a lot of tough things we come up against. What you're saying about groups working on basic ideas, kind of schemas that individuals who engage in harmful activity have to start to look at, their own internal schemas. I have worked a lot at the justice system and have had individuals mandated to me for therapy. And I'm going to refer to one of the books that they use, the justice system. This is juvenile justice for dealing with childhood sex offenders. And it's called Building a Better Life by Dr. Pamela Yates. And it's a workbook, really, for this. But it's talking about the very idea that you brought up, Soy. And it's really that you have to see yourself as an individual who is capable really of engaging in harm with others. And that's a basic idea that's very hard, I think, to accept. Other ideas that they bring up that people carry that are tough to deal with. One is that some people believe that sexual activity with violence is not harmful. And, you know, these are other basic ideas that I think, and this is not with consent on both parties, but just sexual activity without consent and with violence is not harmful. And I think seeing some of these basic ideas out there that people hold, these are important things that have to be addressed and really talked about in the therapeutic work.
Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know if I'm hearing you correctly, but I think, Lynn, you were saying that some people hold the idea that sex without violence, without consent, is seen as not harmful to some people. Is that what I heard?
That's correct. Maybe yeah. I'm not.
I want to make sure I heard it correctly.
Language here. I have to do better with this.
No, not at all. I think my mind is just racing because I just have so many thoughts. And that actually makes me think about like more education too, right? Because when I'm talking to folks, whether they've been harmed or they're the ones who have harmed, I think the language around what is considered sexual violence or assault is so vague that people, and then we all kind of turn to media, right? So we're thinking, okay, what does sexual assault look like? What does rape look like? We think about this really violent thing. When no, that's not sexual violence. In fact, if you look at the umbrella in the, I think, legal terms, sexual assault is, it includes things like harassment. And I think like, what's the one thing called like voyeurism where you show yourself to people? That's also considered sexual assault. It's not always these really gory, violent things. And I think there needs to be more education around that too.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. Voyeurism is really the looking, you know,
the looking. Okay.
You're looking at people, and that is assaultive too. I work with people who've installed cameras in places so they can photograph and look at people. And that takes a lot of activity to do that. And, you know, you're a lot of energy, but you may not recognize that that is an assaultive process that you're engaging in when you do that. And I think it gets back to our society and how we talk about both sex and violence. They're both tough subjects to talk about. We don't have simple words for them, Soy. We really don't. And to limit the harmful behaviors in each of those arenas is tough. It really is. So no wonder that the, you know, humans find their way into the holes and the valleys and around these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. And I don't want to take up so much space. I'm curious, Valerie, if you have like thoughts or things coming up for you.
I mean, I just kind of think like it really has to be with the individual coming to terms with what abuse is, because if they are abusive and it's, you know, working in their favor and there's no really repercussions from the system, or it's just people are maybe, I don't know, I guess I'm thinking more like domestic violence kind of, but yeah, I just think this accountability part is super important. And thinking about the, you know, the article title that you mentioned where it's just this like bad men can change or whatever, like that's going to get internalized by them. Like they're going to think they're a bad person and that there's just not a place for them. And it's so counterproductive because like on the one hand, like, yeah, they're facilitating this conversation about like a very difficult topic, but you're also starting it off with the headline that like these people are bad, when think of how many people have experienced sexual abuse. Like for every person that has been sexually abused, there's an abuser somewhere. And just think of how many people are reading that and probably don't, you know, really feel good about themselves when they see that. So I just think it's counterproductive.
Well, I think seeing it, Valerie, as bad behavior really helps. Good people, you know, all people can engage in bad behavior and harmful behavior to other people.
Yeah.
So it's really recognizing that from the very beginning, starting in, I think of my little grandson in first grade. You know, he has little boys hitting him. He's hit other little kids, you know, but knowing, understanding he's not a bad person because he's hit other people. Even his little friends who hit him are not bad people, but they're engaging in a bad activity, you know, that's really hurting them. But even in the first grade, in his little class, I find there's an unwillingness to have these frank conversations about what's going on. Yeah. And if this is first grade boys in America, you know, where do they go down the road is really the question with this.
They become CEOs.
other things.
The other thing that I get really frustrated with is, and this is something I talk with a lot with my partner, because he does work with folks who've been in any way, shape, or form involved with the justice system and their loved ones. And we've talked a lot about this, where systems are set up in a way that people can't get help or can't get better, especially for people who have some sort of sexual offense on their record, because they, for example, for someone who has harmed a young person, they can't be in within a certain distance from schools. They can't be within a certain distance of da-da-da-da. And what does that leave them with, right? Like, where can they live? Are they going to just be around other people who've also made similar offenses, and some of who don't care if they had these offenses? Some don't have any remorse, they'll care about getting better. Or some people are too sick. They can't actually get the help that they need because of other illnesses and comorbidities. And so we're putting them in this place where they can't get better. And why is recidivism so high? Because they're probably going to try to do things to try to get a better life or blah, blah, blah. And I think he and I were talking about some of the crime reports that he read. And most of the time, the reason why people are back in prison or in jail, it's usually not related to their original offense. It's usually because maybe they broke probation or blah, 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 blah. Something not related. And I think it's just so frustrating. It is absolutely frustrating unless you have the resources.
The question of the resources brings us back to, we're working in a system that doesn't have enough resources really for people who've been victimized. And then you add on to it that you and I, all of us believe that you have to treat those who victimize others to really, that's important. It's really a dyad, you know, to treat both sides of it, you know, those who are being abused and those who abuse. And if you don't treat the abusers, you know, you're really left with this whole population that is still out there, and you're living in a very scary world, really, for everyone. And you're discounting all of those people as not really being worth treating. So I think looking at that side, you've really got to look at, we've got limited resources, yet we've really got to spend time, energy, and money on both these groups. This is really true with pedophiles. You know, I've been using that word. I feel strange, so I have to what you said, but it's a term, you know, for those who engage. And let's say those who have been designated pedophiles, there are pedophiles who never engage in harmful behavior, and they have to be, you know, acknowledged and commended, you know. But then there are pedophiles who engage in harmful behavior toward children. And that leads to these situations that you're talking about around the schools and things like that, where they can't live around schools. But, you know, what has always struck me about this, because I've worked with individuals who have been, you know, remanded for treatment of pedophilia, and, you know, they can never change. Once you're on the registry and you're listed as such, there's no way off of that, really. So you're always recorded in the neighborhood where you're living. It limits your life. And, you know, you are seen as a pariah, you know, and that is a very hard group to be part of and to really work your way out of, basically.
A few things came up for me when you were saying that, because one of the things one of my colleagues and I would love to do is to provide more resources for people who've harmed others in like in a sexual way. And I think she and I were talking about running a group for them, and because it's so lacking. Like, I work in the San Mateo County area and it's really lacking, right? And it's something that, and I don't think, if a clinician doesn't feel comfortable with this area and they don't feel comfortable with it, that's their boundary and that's their right. And I don't think that they should force themselves to just because resources are lacking. But for those who are interested in working with these folks, it's such a needed area. It's such a needed resource. And so I want to encourage people who are listening and people who are clinicians that are interested to explore that, because it's not, like you were saying, Lynn, you know, it's not just working with people who've been harmed. When I've noticed when I work with the people who harmed others, I'm kind of using very similar interventions. We're working on things like identity. We're working on things like relationship with other people and communication. We're working on this internal sense of self and not all this like shame and guilt that comes from what happened. You know, Chanel Miller wrote a really beautiful victim impact statement. For those who don't know who she is, she was the one who was assaulted by Brock Turner, also known as, they called him, I don't even want to say it, but basically it was something that happened in Stanford. And she, I'm not going to say it the way that she said it, but she says in her statement that it's not just him and it's not just her who are affected individually. Their lives have become intertwined because of what had happened between them. And it's a similar thing. When you've been harmed by someone else, you don't just go your separate ways. There are impacts that are lasting sometimes. And it's important to be able to look at both and to be able to recover or heal from both, in my opinion.
That whole story, you know, of Brock Turner that you mentioned is an important one, because you are so true in saying the lives are intertwined. One of the other podcasts we talked about recently was about sibling abuse. And there you have one sibling who's being abused, or maybe more than one, and you have more than one or one who's doing the abuse. and yet it's happening in the same family. And I like to think of this as the model for overall abuse. It's happening in the same broader family or culture, but all these individuals are part of it. So it is important that we have, you know, treatment for both and ways to talk about it. I think a couple of things I've found to be successful. One is for therapists working in this population or with this population to be non-judgmental if they can be. Second, to educate themselves as much as they can about this population. I think that's helpful. I think also, because I work a lot with children, it's helpful to have a developmental approach where you recognize that many who engage in harmful behaviors toward others were harmed at earlier points in their development. So they were harmed as a child. They were possibly harmed by parents or other children or school. So there is a way, you know, that their attitudes were impacted on by early development. I did a study once where I abused pedophiles who were in prison. And I looked at early patterns of childhood abuse. All were sexually abused as children. So you really see how these ideas start early. And these individuals that I interviewed in the prison were even completely unaware of this. They'd never talked with anybody about this earlier history. Nobody had ever asked them really about it. You know, so it's pretty impressive, I think, that that whole thing is being disregarded. But I think those are some of the points that I think have been helpful to me around working with individuals with this. And the other thing I always think about with you, Soy, you always say to not overburden ourselves. And I think part of that is you can only have so many patients talking about the same issues at the same time. So I try to limit for my own sanity, you know, the amount of patients that I'm working with who have been abused or who have engaged in abuse or self-harm, just because it's hard to be available to everybody.
Yeah. But I'm sorry, I'm trying to step back and be mindful of how much space you take. So I'm wondering, Valerie.
You know, actual experience in the field with these people and experience treating. So I really appreciate hearing both of your stories and everything you say is so well said. And love the Chanel Miller reference. I think she, you know, is such a strong voice and beautiful writer.
Yeah.
Well, you brought up, Valerie, this organization from Berlin, the Institute of Sexology and Sexual Medicine, and they go by the online name of Charity.
Okay.
You know, which I think is an interesting name to choose. But they've developed an internet tool called Troubled Desire. It's an internet-based tool for self-management. And this is a very prominent sexology institute in Berlin that works with a lot of people who've engaged in sexually abusive activities. And I think this is useful. It's a very human way that they talk about the problems and how to engage in it. And I think it's helpful for people to see that our American way of looking at things is not the only way in the world. And there are other areas where they're starting to look at this and talk about it and treat it in more open ways.
Yeah, it makes you really see how behind America is with mental health care, especially. These places in Germany are something I learned about in one of my classes. Just made me kind of think about like harm reduction and kind of reminded me of like open injection sites. But instead of for drug abusers, it's tailored for sex abusers. So I'm sure, you know, I know open injection sites are very controversial, but they are part of harm reduction. And I think that these places follow that model and they're shown to be effective already. So I think definitely something to keep an eye on. And I think maybe the more people that can help create an environment like the ones being created in Germany, the better. And that's my rant about these places.
I'm actually looking up the place right now because that sounds really fascinating. I wonder how they implement harm reduction models for people who, it looks like for juveniles who have harmed others sexually. anyway, I can do my own research, but it just, that sounds really fascinating and very curious. And I would love to see our Western culture implement things differently, because it is really painful.
That program is really headed by a Dr. Beyer, B-E-I-E-R, out of Berlin. And you are right, Soy. It really looks, it begins with adolescents and juveniles, young people who've engaged in these activities. And, you know, in looking at research in the field of dealing with those who've engaged in sexual harm with others, if you can intervene early, you with treatment, you have much, much better opportunity to help individuals change these behavioral patterns. So that's one of the things I would say as a child and adolescent therapist, it's really important that people get treatment in childhood and adolescence for these behaviors. Really important, because they don't become as ingrained. They don't become lifelong issues. It's just really, it opens you up to seeing a lot of other things in the world. And I think it's really a good opportunity to treat young people who are in this arena.
Yeah, that actually just sparked the thought too, that if you're involved with the justice system later on as an adult, like as a juvenile, I think you have more resources to bounce back from whatever the offense or the conviction was. But as an adult, I think I've found that the legal system can be particularly traumatic for both parties, like the one who's been harmed, the one who has harmed. And that's really hard to come back from too. And then there are less resources available to be to rehabilitate. Totally agree. I think early intervention is so needed and important. And I am not one who likes working, who I think can specialize in working with children. So I don't know how you do it, Lynn. It's amazing work.
Well, I think becoming a grandmother has helped a lot, you know, and I am a hands-on type grandmother. So I'm still on the playground and I'm watching these kids and I'm looking at the behavior that's going down there. And I'm thinking they still need the help. So I'm willing to be there, you know, and do that. You know, I think it's a hard group to work with because there's not a lot of education and children are underfunded. So their education is underfunded. The teachers don't get the help they need with violence in the classroom. And forget the sexual violence. They're not getting the other help. And you know, I've been doing some volunteer work related to the grandkids, and I see the teachers are asking for help with all this other stuff, you know, and it's not just this one area. But I do think, you know, that again, all the studies point to, if you can get help for children engaged in these behaviors, it makes a huge difference in their life. So that's the time to get the interventions. But working with adults, I work with a lot of people in their 20s, and you're doing God's work too. So if you're working with people in their 20s and 30s are not easy, and they're often still dealing with child issues, things that happen to them.
Yeah. And it's some of them, I think it's like their first time in therapy, right? Like folks who come in, they haven't gone before. Otherwise, maybe this wouldn't have become an issue. Who knows? So it's the first time in therapy for a lot of folks. And they're also working on something so shameful already and something so challenging. It's a great amount of work for sure.
One of the other things I've seen, Soy, is when somebody's, trust me, and they've been in therapy with me for a while, let's say more than a year, they are more likely to bring up these behaviors, that they've engaged in these shameful behaviors, these sexually or violently abusive behaviors toward others. So if you can, as a therapist, I think, be alert and ask about these things in an unjudgmental way and try to be open to hearing them. You know, often after I've listened to how they've been abused, they will tell me things they've done and share with me. And that's a way that I think all therapists open the path for this. You know, we are listening. We are trying to help and work with people. And we're more likely to hear these stories, you know, if we follow up on them.
Yeah, but I want to throw this out there because this just happened recently, but a systems issue. As a therapist, that I don't think that it's wrong for this to be there. I understand, and in some ways, I'm glad that they have this, but like mandated reporting laws, right? So if someone is to tell someone, like a mandated reporter, even if it's a historical thing, that there's a possibility of that getting reported. And so how safe is it really to talk about some of these things, even to a clinician? And I really struggle with that because I want it to be a safe space for folks. And I also have this mandate. And so what are people left with? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how to resolve that. I don't know what's right or wrong. I don't know I just don't know the answer. And it sucks.
Well, it's a hard thing. I think, you know, we can be caught as therapists and it can definitely affect the therapy and disclosure. I think what I'll just tell you from my experience, not that it's 100% right, but I generally, when I'm at those junctures and I feel somebody is about ready to disclose that, I remind them, you know, that I am I have to report certain things when there is risk to other people. And if they are going to tell me those things, there might be benefit to them in disclosing and we could work on it. And we could maybe partner with, you know, the agencies to work in that way. I have had people stop at that point and then not disclose further because they understand the boundary that I'm talking about. And I've had people go forward, many more go forward and disclose, and we try to work on it together. So I agree with you. That's a hard point, but I think we inform our patients of the risk if they do disclose, and we try to partner and work with them, because the advantage to disclosure is they get the opportunity to talk about it and to get better and to have their real self out there and known, you know, and that's helpful, I think.
Yeah. I know that some people feel a relief sometimes when there has been a report made or when, you know, there is involvement with the legal system, because then it's kind of all out there and they don't have to keep it inside anymore. And then there's also the part that they have, this other part that they have to face, which is like the legal process and the, what do you call it? Like the shame from other people that they, they're really harsh, I think, on them. And maybe, I don't know, in their minds, rightfully so, but I also don't want to take away from people who have been harmed, because I'm sure it has been painful. Yeah, it's just a tricky situation.
You know, you bring up again the people who have been harmed, and the people who have been harmed that I've worked with, if the person who harmed them gets treatment, you know, agrees to engage in treatment and then apologizes on some broader level through a conversation, that means so much, I think, to people who have been harmed. It really does, because that is a key part of the whole thing, that they have an honest conversation about what happened. So I really think we're just at the beginning of starting this in our treatment world, in our culture, to have these conversations after people have gotten, you know, the treatment and the responsibility and other things around the actions. And it's really, really important.
Yeah. Totally. I hear you, Lynn. Like, I know so many folks who are just like, I think I don't give a damn about the money. I just don't want this person to go do this to somebody else, or I just don't want to get hurt like that again. Like, they just don't want that to happen anymore, no matter how that happens.
That reminds me of the Brock Turner and Chanel Miller example again, how, you know, when you cross paths once, and just because you go separate ways physically after, you're still like affected by that kind of, and I think he needs to apologize. I don't know if he ever apologized, but you know, that whole story is just so upsetting in so many different ways. But in my grad school courses this week, we learned about mandated reporting. So this conversation sounds very familiar to one I had earlier this week. You guys said everything really just perfectly. So,
well, just to say more about the Brock Miller Valerie, because I think as part of that legal case, he was required, there was some apology required in that case, but it never was really, you know, satisfactory, certainly, you know, to the young woman who had the experience of that.
Yeah.
You know, we're not giving the specifics of it, but it's available out there and involves a young woman in a very distressed state being really aggressed upon sexually. Very disturbing story.
Yeah.
But again, I think the culture has to encourage things like apology.
Yes.
The culture has to encourage taking responsibility for these actions. And what we were talking about earlier, Soy, not seeing people who do violent actions as totally bad people and making them pariahs, because it becomes very hard to accept that, you know, and that situation. So it is a tough bind there, but it's apology and human conversations are a way to really make this better. And early for young people who have engaged in it, learning how to converse and say, I'm sorry, when you've engaged in a violent behavior as a child, you know, you're a little child, you did it and you don't want it done to you and you don't want to do it to other people. But that's a model for later life, what should be done.
Yeah, I know we're kind of close to time and I wanted to maybe say one last thing. I think I love the part about human conversation because I want to say like 90% of the time when I've worked with folks that had been harmed, the question that they always ask is why me? Like, why did they hurt me? And there's a whole, I think, psychological thing there. And the reason why people ask that, but I think it's so healing to hear from the person who hurt you that it's not because of anything you've done. It was because of me and something I need to work on in myself. And if we can have more conversations like that, I think it could be healing for so many more people.
I agree with you, Soy. And I think it's a good place to close because I think that would make all the difference to so many people if they heard that. And in a way, the abuse is often random. You know, the victim did not do anything to bring it on themselves. It is a random event that takes place, you know, in the mind of the perpetrator. And the person was there. The victim is there, you know, at the site where the abuse will happen, but, you know, really did not bring that on themselves in any overt way. It's hard sometimes to accept that, you know, you do want to think if you change things, you could control it, but, you know, that's not the case. These are hard behaviors to control.
Oh, thank you both so much for this conversation. And just, I really am so grateful to have the space to talk about something that's really challenging. And I really hope this is helpful to folks. And sure, it is hard to hear for other folks. And I think we can all agree that we are open to hearing from everyone.
Well, thank you both, Valerie and Soy. And we'll end it for today. Come on. That's what I'm about to say.